Intelligent design and DNA. The scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. I have in front of me from the journal Science, January 23rd, 2015, about the Comet 67P that the European Space Agency is currently, in fact, they're following this comet toward its perihelion, its closest distance to the sun, which will happen later this summer. And they sent a lander on it about a month ago or so. And there is a shocking discovery that has been made, and the photos are being released, and wow, what a thrill. Let me go back to December of 2014, an article on this also in Science, and it's titled Dinosaur Eggs. Now, they're just using that as a figure of speech, not actual dinosaur eggs. They mean the size of these things, actually a lot bigger than dinosaur eggs. Anyway, dinosaur eggs spotted on Rosetta's Comet 67P. They are saying that they're seeing nodules in fresh pit walls and cliff faces on Comet 67P, and these nodules could be the evidence of the fundamental units of comet formation. And so Eric Hand, who is a science journalist with the journal Science, writes that Comet 67P has a cauliflower-like texture over much of its surface, not all, but much, like goosebumps. Scientists using the Rosetta spacecraft, which arrived at 67P in August and became the first mission to orbit and land on a comet, now think they may have discovered the source of these patterns on cliff faces and in deep pits, layer upon layer of rounded nodules, rounded. How does a rock get rounded in space? We'll talk this through. 1 to 3 meters across. That means up to 10 meters in diameter. These are large boulders. These spherules, dubbed dinosaur eggs, could be the fundamental building blocks that clump together to form the comet. Now, Eric Hand and the journal Science, they go on to describe the difficulty with that, which we will discuss. But first, let me read to you a prediction. The prediction 13 years ago in the 7th edition of Dr. Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning, discussing comets and asteroids and what they're comprised of, their formation, how they formed. Here's prediction 37. Most of the rocks, pebble-sized and larger, comprising asteroids and comets, will be found to be rounded to some degree. This rounding occurred as they tumbled and were eroded in the powerful fountains of the Great Deep. If you're a listener to Real Science Radio, you know we've discussed the hydroplate theory, Dr. Walt Brown's explanation of the processes involved in the global flood described in the book of Genesis. Well, to talk through all of this with us, what an honor to have back on the air on Real Science Radio, Dr. Walt Brown. Welcome back.
Thank you, Bob. Good to be with you.
It's a thrill to talk to you, Walt, because as we read these articles, they keep coming out on this Comet 67P. What an amazing achievement by the European Space Agency. And boy, time and time again, they're affirming the predictions that appear in your book In the Beginning.
And the American Association for the Advancement of Science has labeled that whole mission the most significant scientific achievement of the year.
Wow. Yeah, and it's the first time that a comet, I mean, we did NASA a few years back, plunged into a comet to send up debris, and that was during a flyby. This is, we actually have a craft orbiting this comet for months, and it sent a lander, and hopefully the lander might come back to life later toward the summer. We'll see. So could we talk, Walt, about what they found and why it's a surprise to them? They found what looks like boulders, rocks, and thousands or more of them on Comet 67P.
Layer upon layer, and you see them in pictures that show craters. The entire crater wall is just layer upon layer of these 10-foot diameter boulders, well-rounded. And you can see them in cliffs elsewhere on the comet, where they have fallen out of the cliff and left their imprint in the cliff. They fall out of the cliff and end up at the bottom of the cliff.
In piles of boulders. So these are pretty obviously rocks. They're not just some kind of a conglomerate of dust particles.
That's right. They're solid.
Well, another article in the journal Science from 2014 says that, and it's about the lander and the Rosetta mission and Comet 67P. It says comets are lumps of dust, ice, and organic molecules and do not contain rocks per se. Nevertheless, the lander, Philae, the lander was caught in a hard place next to something that looked very much like a rock. And so not just one rock, but it appears thousands or more rocks.
Millions.
Millions of rocks, even on this comet 67P. So there's something called an aggregation barrier that has led this secular world of astronomy to claim that you wouldn't really have comets made up of large rocks. What is the aggregation barrier? It's written about here in these articles, but could
you
explain it?
Two dust particles to stick together because of electrostatic forces, or there's another more complicated force that could hold them together, but not very firmly.
So out in space, where they believe there was a swirling nebula of dust that eventually formed the sun and the planets, and they think some of that formed comets and asteroids, so that dust, you could have bits, particles of dust clumped together into, according to the journal Science here, they say maybe up to about a centimeter in diameter.
Yeah, little clumps. But when another particle comes in and is wanting to be added to that clump, it's coming in at a pretty high velocity. Velocities in space are very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it hits that clump, it's going to blast at the smithereens,
Right. Scatter
everything.
Right.
So how do they build something up beyond, let's say, a centimeter in diameter?
So that's their aggregation barrier. If you're going to get dust to stick together, they're saying what we expected to find were maybe marble-sized. Mm-hmm. You know, they call these things dinosaur eggs, which is fun, of course. They didn't call them robin eggs, you know, these little blue robin eggs. That's what they were expecting to find. But what they found are these, in 1 to 3 meters, we're talking about up to 10 feet in diameter. Indeed, thousands are apparently probably, as you said, millions in a single comet. So first of all, how do these rocks form, which is a challenge to their secular worldview? But then how are they rounded? How do you round a rock that forms in space?
Well, you may have them in your front yard. They're called river rocks. We see them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Rocks at the bottom of a river get tumbled and eroded, and over many years, they're rounded.
Right.
So that can happen for tiny rocks, but there are no rivers on a comet. So how does that happen?
Hmm. And these are large, 3 feet in diameter, 5, 10 feet in diameter. How do you round a rock that size?
Well, you better have a very rapid flow.
Hmm.
What's called hypervelocity flow, faster than anything that we can see here on Earth. If it's caught in that flow, it will tumble.
Right.
And the sharp edges will get rounded off, like sandpaper would round off a piece of wood.
So for those who have not listened to our previous programs on the hydroplate theory, we encourage them to go to our website, realscienceradio.com/flood. That'll get you there, /global flood. Or /hydroplate theory, or even just /HPT. But the hydroplate theory takes a very careful look at the book of Genesis and sees that when God created the earth, there were waters below the crust, the firmament, and waters above. And during the global flood, the fountains of the great deep broke forth so that the water for the flood came from under the crust. It didn't come from up in the sky. Came from under the crust, and Walt, that water was maybe 20 miles or so below the surface of the earth and coming up with enormous energy, highly energetic flow, and so the rock and debris that it brought with it would be tumbling, and that flow would reach escape velocity. And as we've discussed on the air, and you document in your book and all the evidence for it, that's what would form the meteoroids, asteroids, and the comets of the solar system.
Right. The largest rocks launched were 200 meters in diameter. They then became seed rocks that attracted gravitationally other particles that were traveling near it and in about the same direction. And all the gas and water vapor that was in that mixture took energy out of the smaller rocks that are orbiting the seed rock. And so eventually all of that merged together. And the more it merged, the more it could pull in from around it. So it was an accelerating process.
So if you happen to have, if we gave to an atheistic astronomer, if we gave them millions of rocks out in the solar system flying around, then he has to somehow bring them all together to form these asteroids and comets. Mm-hmm. And so one problem is, as if they did begin to attract one another gravitationally, overwhelmingly, and this is confirmed by computer simulations, they speed up as they approach each other and they pass at great speed. That's the norm. That's what would normally happen.
That's right.
The other problem is if they did hit, they'd collide and break up into smaller pieces.
That's right.
And so it's this aggregation barrier that I'm so thrilled that with this, you know, greatest comet discovery, maybe ever, certainly greatest accomplishment, at the same time they're presenting it to the public, they are presenting the problem, which is the aggregation barrier.
Yes, the European Space Agency people kept these pictures under lock and key for
quite a while,
well over a month.
Yeah,
they couldn't explain it.
Yeah,
and finally, people were beating on their door saying, "Let us see those pictures."
Yeah, right.
And so they finally came out. This comet looks like a rubber ducky, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. A very unusual shape.
It looks like two globes that have merged, and that presents a problem to them. Their first reaction would be, "Yes, those two lobes merge," but the problem you just described gives them fits, because if two smaller comets merged, they would smash each other to smithereens, because velocities in space are very rapid, very high, miles
right.
per second.
Now,
so how did they merge gently? Well, they merged gently because they were orbiting each other, and there was a lot of gas orbiting each of them.
Aerobraking.
And that gas takes energy out of their orbits, and they slowly, gently degrade and merge.
And to a secular cosmologist who might be addressing how would comets form, they think this happens over millions of years. And so, of course, any vapor, water vapor, it would be gone in a
That's
very
right.
short
It'd
time.
It'd be gone in hours.
Yeah, so there's not going to be the time for these to form. Now, with the fountains of the great deep, as the rock and mud and water is launched, it's being launched at a similar trajectory, at a similar rate of speed, at the same time, so that you have all this material that's reached escape velocity, leaves Earth's gravity, and it's all going in the same direction with all this water vapor. And so that explains how it could all come together to clump into asteroids and comets.
Yeah, the different particles' speed relative to each other is very small.
Right.
Even though their absolute velocity is gigantic.
Compared to the solar system, right. So there's a quote in the journal Science here from an astrophysicist with John Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, and Carrie Liss, and he says, "We're not getting marbles, but we're getting dinosaur eggs. They're about a factor of 10 to 100 bigger than predicted." And so, again, that's the aggregation barrier. So, Walt, this prediction, when you wrote this in the 7th edition of your book, now the 8th edition is out. We sell it here at Real Science Radio. That was 13 years before this discovery. You have other similar predictions. So, Walt, this is slightly off topic, but it's related. Your prediction 38, which follows prediction 37, that asteroids spinning faster than 10 rotations per day will be found to be single, well-rounded rocks. I could, just from your explanation of the hydroplate theory, I could now understand why you would say they'd be well-rounded. Even though it's hard to get these things rounded in space, this is a rock ejected by the fountains of the Great Deep. So as it's coming up, say, 20 miles toward the surface of the Earth, it's spinning in this tremendous rapid flow, and it's becoming rounded.
That's right. The velocities of the fountains of the Great Deep reach 32 miles per second.
Wow, escape velocity is 7,
and so
right?
A rock caught in that fast wind, call it a wind, has this flow of gas around it that's much faster than the rock is eventually going to reach. Once the rock reaches 7 miles per second, it will escape the Earth's gravity. But the air and the flow of this water vapor and other stuff around it lifts it and accelerates it up to over 7 miles per second.
The idea that it would be a single rock, you say it would be a single well-rounded rock. If it's spinning that fast, then it seems that other rocks that might have had a tendency to land on its surface would be flung away.
That's right.
Okay, so that's quite a prediction. When the Rosetta mission released these photos, and I was sharing with my wife, Cheryl, your prediction from 13 years ago, and then here are these photos showing what appear to be just thousands of boulders and pits in the cliff walls where the boulders fell out, Cheryl said, boy, Walt must spend decades thinking this stuff through. And what's so amazing to me is if you have a framework that is valid, the more you think through the implications of that framework, you begin to make predictions about comets and asteroids and meteoroids that would never occur to anyone who didn't have that basic insight.
And for some people, they're shocking. So shocking, they want to say Walt Brown is wrong.
Well, sure, of course.
If they say it before they have read the reasons I lay out for why I'm right.
Now, Walt, it's difficult for the secular astronomers to explain so many features of comets and asteroids. One is the moons. They keep finding moons on asteroids. The latest is just this January 2015.
About 11% of the asteroids have moons that have been seen. And there's probably many more that have not been seen.
That have not been seen because of the smaller ones. And we just had a relatively small asteroid pass by the Earth just a week ago or so, about 3 times the distance of the moon. And lo and behold, NASA spotted, they got video even of it and photographs. It has a moon in tow about 230 feet in diameter. That's pretty tiny.
Right.
And back 2 years ago, Kevin Lee and I were on the air, and it's known that asteroids have moons, which is somewhat inexplicable to secular astronomers because how do they capture them in space? We've just been describing that problem. But we are thinking, Kevin and I, that because the mechanism of how asteroids formed is known from the fountains of the Great Deep, it's going to be increasingly common that they're going to find many of these things. Perhaps most have moons and complex debris fields.
That's right. Prior to 1993, a number of astronomers were saying, I think there might be a moon about that asteroid. But other astronomers would scoff at the possibility because how in the world could an asteroid capture a moon? And the scoffing ended when one of the spacecraft going by an asteroid took a picture and you could see it. From then on, there was no more scoffing.
Right, because here's one. And now when Kevin and I did that show in February 2013, the next close-up view of an asteroid was QE2 3 months later. Sure enough, it had a moon in tow. And then this January 2015, asteroid BL86, it's only about 1,000 feet in diameter, and it too had this moon, 230 feet in diameter. So it seems like it was shocking and utterly unexpected to secular astronomers, but it seems like it's the norm. Being the norm is more evidence that's consistent with the fountains of the Great Deep.
It makes perfect sense if you understand the flood. And to understand the flood, you need to first answer, where is the water coming from? Then you need to understand why there was so much energy that could lift rocks that are up to 200 meters in diameter and expel them away from the earth.
The secular scientists who disagree with all this, of course, if they reject that there's a God, they're not going to believe in the Bible and the book of Genesis being history or the global flood. But there are creation scientists who believe in the Bible and Genesis and that the earth is young, yet they bought into some model of plate tectonics. They call it catastrophic plate tectonics. Or they bought into the vapor canopy theory, both of which are secular models that creationists are trying to adapt to the Bible. But when they look at these discoveries, Walt, it seems that they have almost as hard a time explaining them as the atheistic scientists, because their view of the flood cannot help them explain comets and asteroids.
That's right. And if you talk to them and ask them, have you ever read the hydroplate theory, they will say they haven't.
Well, many, many of them have not. They've rejected it out of hand.
Or they've read just a little piece of it, and they immediately say, this is crazy. Well, I'm the first person to say it's a crazy idea until you look at the evidence.
Right. And I know a number of creation scientists have looked at parts of the theory that they feel are in their domain. Like a geologist might look at the formation of mountains and trenches, and an astronomer look at comets and asteroids. But it was one event. And as one event, it's not broken up in our neat little disciplines.
The world is not divided into academic disciplines. Schools are divided into academic disciplines.
Right. So you need
cross. This subject of the flood is interdisciplinary.
Right.
Because the flood was so powerful, so dramatic, it wiped all but eight people off the earth that it impacted almost every field of science.
So that if a creation scientist doesn't recognize that these mavericks of the solar system, which are dangerous because they do kill people on Earth, I mean, there are impacts occasionally. Mm-hmm. If they don't recognize that they were formed from the global flood, which gives us a mechanism, right, in the pages of Genesis.
And the fact that these things are dangerous, as you say, tells us right away that wasn't the situation when God created the earth.
Right, because it was created very good.
It was very good.
And
you
so,
wouldn't have some asteroid hitting you on the head.
Right, and you also wouldn't have had radioactivity in the crust of the earth, because that brings about birth defects and all, and worse. And so something catastrophic happened to cause the solar system itself to be a dangerous place to live, let alone just the crust of the earth.
And that radioactivity on the earth was also produced as a consequence of the flood. It wasn't there before the flood. If it had been, then mutation and death would have resulted.
Right. So there would never have been.
After the creation, which God told us was very good.
Right. There wouldn't have been a Garden of Eden, a perfect creation.
Death didn't come until after the creation.
Right, exactly. And by the way, Fred Williams and I did a whole show on the origin of Earth's radioactivity. Walt, that's one of my favorite chapters in your book. Thank you so much for that chapter. So much fun. Here we are. We keep a list of the confirmed predictions from the hydroplate theory at realscienceradio.com/predictions. So, Walt, this is yet another confirmed prediction. Predictions are the currency of science. If you could look at the world around us and make predictions based on your model, that's really valuable. It gives people some degree of confidence that either this model is correct or it's worth considering. We see time and time again that the secular scientists are in shock. Every time they're in shock about what they find, we are ecstatic, because it's confirming the book of Genesis over and over again.
We, and I'm sure all your listeners, have heard many theories, many explanations put out for something. A good question to ask people, such as me or others, who put out these explanations, What predictions would you make if you are correct? That's a scary thing to do.
Yeah.
For a person who's laid out a theory.
And Walt, you have dozens of very specific predictions in the hydroplate theory, and some of them that have been confirmed, for example, pooled water under mountain ranges.
Yes, that was the first one.
That was the first. Deep channels under the Bosphorus and the Gibraltar Straits. Salt on Mars. These are the ones that have been confirmed already. Water inside of large asteroids. Carbon-14 in old bones, old being in quotes, because they're not all that old. And so now we have yet another confirmed prediction, number 37, thanks to the European Space Administration. So we've had to update our article on confirmed creation predictions. So thank you for doing this work, Walt. It's just thrilling.
A couple things to watch in prediction. Don't be fooled by somebody who predicts the sun's going to rise tomorrow.
Right.
The prediction has to be something that is shocking.
Yeah.
Next thing to ask, has it been put in writing? And can I see that it was published long before this discovery was made?
Right. And when it's counter to what is expected by the scientific community, and then it is confirmed, as so many of your predictions have been, it's just thrilling.
Another requirement of prediction, it needs to be something that could be verified in the next 10, 20, or 30 years. Edward Halley, discoverer of Halley's Comet, he was criticized because he predicted that this comet was going to come back,
mm-hmm.
a comet that bears his name today, Halley's Comet. But he predicted it was going to come back long after he would be dead. And so he
What's
was criticized
good of that?
For
right.
predicting something that could never
right.
embarrass him.
So, Walt, we're about out of time. I'd like to encourage people listening to get two resources. One is the book, In the Beginning. We make it available at realscienceradio.com, or you could call us, 1-800-8-NYART. 1-800-836-9278. And then, Walt, and this is a bit self-serving of me, but our video, The Global Flood and the Hydroplate Theory, we have that available now. Not only is it in Blu-ray and DVD, but it's also available download. People could start watching it just within minutes if they just get it right now. Walt, thank you so very much for joining us here. What a thrill. We look forward to the next confirmed prediction from the hydroplate theory.
Thank you so much, Bob.
You're very welcome. That was Dr. Walt Brown, and our favorite scientist, Fred Williams, couldn't be here today. But Fred Williams and Bob Enyart, we just appreciate Walt's work so much. Hope you do too. Certainly study it. If you don't think it's valid, study it, and then call us up. Fred or I will be happy to talk with you about it. Our website again, realscienceradio.com, or take the shortcut, rsr.org. Click on the store in the science department. I think you'll love the video and the book. May God bless you.
Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.